Security concerns and general aviation. How big a problem is this? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for the download. Today, we're going to hear the second of four parts of my interview with Rod Hightower, who became the new president of the Experimental Aircraft Association on September 7th. Yesterday, Rod told us how he got his start in aviation as a wide-eyed kid. Today, is overreaching security at airports fencing out potential candidates?
Well, first of all, I don't know that a fence around an airport is truly a problem in the sense that it keeps people out of aviation. Where I think it is a new challenge is that it is sending and communicating an unwelcome signal. So there are some wonderful airports out there. One of my favorite to talk about is Galesburg, Illinois, and the FBO is managed by a very enlightened guy by the name of Harold Timmons. That Galesburg airport has a fence around it. But that Galesburg airport, generally speaking, is a very warm and welcoming place. Well, no one even notices the fence when you show up at Galesburg. There's always someone to talk to, somebody to bring you in and let you experience, you know, aviation at its finest, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing that I worry about, Paul, and by the way, I think the industry should be worried about it. I think the public should be worried about what it's doing as well. And that is that aviation is important to America. It's very important to the economic vitality of this country. And I'll tell you something, if you haven't noticed in the past 3 years, we haven't exactly been as vitalic as we want to be, economically speaking. But part of that importance of aviation is also what it does for communities. And if a community puts up a high chain link fence with razor wire across the top of it, it's sending and articulating a message that it probably does not really mean to send. The other thing that I think that all of the aviation community needs to really rally around and get their hand around is this overzealous approach to aviation security, particularly when it comes to general aviation. I think there is a significant need to make what I call fact-based decision-taking. And if there was ever a time in our government where fact-based decision-making should be taken a second look at right now, it is this entire security issue with GA. There is not a proven credible threat. There is not evidence that general aviation airplanes can do substantial damage to the national security. In fact, they enhance it, as all of our congressmen and government officials can tell you. That's how they travel about the country. So I can assure you that fact-based decision based on logic, intellect, and empirical data has gone out the window for some type of a political agenda or almost a national fear-mongering about aviation in general, which is not only unhealthy to aviation, it is unhealthy for the country, and it is unhealthy for the communities that embrace aviation and require aviation to be an integral part of their economic engine.
Is there anything you or EAA can do on that front? That seems like just a monolithic, overwhelming obstacle.
You know, I think what makes it monolithic is the scale of the bureaucracy that's pushing the agenda. And the answer is, of course there is, and of course we are. You know, our advocacy efforts at EAA are a significant part of our activity here. We spend a lot of our intellect and a lot of our energy managing advocacy on the behalf of not only our members, but all of aviation. And it's important that our advocacy efforts be well coordinated with AOPA, GAMA, NBA, and others, because together we are so much stronger. We have a very strong and powerful voice of the aviator if we unite and we attack these things systematically and with an approach that lets us build and leverage our strengths. One of the strengths of EAA's advocacy is our relationship with the regulatory process. Our friends at the FAA, our friends at NTSB, our friends at TSA are people that we know, like, and respect. We understand their goals and objectives. We help align with their goals and objectives to make aviation safer. We help those folks become successful at what their mission is. They also work collaboratively with us to help us be successful at what our mission is. And that balance of equity, that balance of understanding, that balanced and united approach to a common set of objectives is not only required for success, in my opinion, it is good for aviation.
All right. You have described basically in the past 5 minutes of our conversation a couple of management challenges. You come from a business background. We should probably talk a little bit about that. Tell us how you got into the business part of your life, and did it interrupt your aviation dreams the way it seems to do for so many people?
Well, first of all, we'll talk about the genesis of the business, and then we'll talk about did it interrupt my aviation. Actually, it enabled my aviation. What interrupted my aviation, so to speak, were all the other requirements of the professional life, the family life, and raising children. Those are the things that consume a lot of a person's available time. So if we talk about, you know, time and money, other things other than business took the time away, certainly. And for me, family is always a priority, always has been, always will be. But in terms of the business, my brother and I were pretty young. I was 15 and my brother was 13. And, of course, you know, we're pretty innovative guys and we like to do things and have a little fun and try to make a little bit of money. So we decided to start a custom hay business. And those of you who know what custom hay is, it's, you know, we basically cut, rake, bale, and transport hay. Pretty straightforward, pretty basic agribusiness type of a model. Well, the asset that we had available to us was a 1968 Ford pickup owned by our father. So we immediately hijacked that as our first mechanism to transport hay. So what started out as two brothers in a truck grew into a very sophisticated operation where we turnkey the process for our farmers and the customers that we had maintained. You know, a couple of things that I'm very proud of about that, and my brother tell you the same thing. You know what? We never lost a customer. We never had a customer leave us in all the years we ran the business. We started it in 1975, and we sold that business in 1984. Now, we let a few customers go by the wayside that I would have to say we politely terminated our relationship with, but we never lost a customer. And what we were teaching ourselves as youngsters at the time that has played a strong role in my entire business career was that we were learning about markets. We were learning about customers. We were learning about competitive strategy, your product offering, and how to find differentiation in the markets that you choose to serve. Now, those weren't the words we even knew to call them at age 15 and 16, but that's exactly what was taking place. And what that has done through my entire career, both in the Fortune 500 world and in the private equity world, has allowed me to create value in a very natural and fundamental way. Now, that started at a very young age, and I can tell you that the act of creating value as a business enterprise is no different at the age of 70 than as it is at the age of 15. It's just your level of understanding of how it really works has obviously moved on over the years. But what that really did for me, when I entered the Fortune 500 world, you've got a lot of very smart, very talented people everywhere at these large corporations, and rightfully so and thankfully so. But you know what my competitive advantage was over the folks that I was surrounded by?
What's that?
It was that experience, that business experience in those early years, Paul, that made the difference. I always acted like an owner. I always felt like an owner, and I took decisions like an owner that were value-based. You don't waste anything. You don't have enough time and money to waste anything. And you focus on the things that not only serve your customers well, but create value for your enterprise. That was my competitive advantage, learned at age 15.
Okay, perfect setup. Given your business background, size up the situation you face at EAA. More with new President Rod Hightower in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Freedom through performance. At Cirrus, performance is not simply the measurement of a single design parameter. Rather, it's a total package. It's optimum balance of speed, efficiency, comfort, safety, ease of flight, and quality. We call it Cirrus Flying 2.0. Aren't you ready to feel the freedom?
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Rod Hightower. Rod, you've talked about aviation and life as management paradigms. Talk for a minute about EAA's challenges from that perspective. Then I want to ask you about one challenge in particular.
Oh, I can't wait to hear your question about that one. First of all, there are a lot of challenges, but let's take it in the context of what EAA really is. It is a wonderful thing to explain what EAA is. There's no other aviation organization like EAA. It is unique in the world of aviation organizations. What I think makes it unique, Paul, is that not only is it a representative member organization whose number one objective is to serve its membership while it serves the aviation community at large, but it also walks the talk. So not only do we do what we say we do in our legislative, regulatory, membership, and outreach processes, we live it every day. We operate a fleet of 15 airplanes. We operate a world-class museum. We operate a world-class living history museum, and we travel that museum with B-17 Ford trimotorized that travel the country, outreaching to people of all ages, all generations, and promoting the story of aviation, promoting the value of aviation as it related to the success of the nation, both commercially with the trimotor for business applications and transportation, as well as the wartime benefit of the B-17 and what that really meant to freedom in the universe, so to speak. So the cause is a pretty good cause, but the organization is very unique. Not only do we have that, we have a very strong membership that is extremely passionate and operates with a very high quality standard, not only in designing, building, restoring, and flying airplanes of all types, but when you see the innovation, the intellect, the creativity that's present on the flight line at AirVenture every year, that's really a reflection of the quality and the caliber of people that make up the EA membership. They're the best of the best. They're the finest people you'll meet in the aviation world. They're the finest people that you'll meet in society. And those people happen to apply their intellect and their talents and skills to furthering aviation of all types.
Oh.
And that's rich. I mean, it's broad, it's deep, and more importantly, or as importantly, it's rich.
Okay, then let me ask you the question that I would ask if this was a company. There are a couple of ways in which EAA is being pulled in different directions just through its growth. If you were a corporation known for a particular product, EAA started in the home of Paul Pobrezny in 1953 with something like 36 members, and the thing they all had in common that they were builders. To some extent, EAA has had to spread its tentacles somewhat and become warbirds, A380s parked on Aeroshell Square, you know, regulatory advocacy, and there's a lot of things going on there. If this was a company, by now, many companies would have realized they'd overdone the line extension and split off into subsidiaries. How do you manage that thing? I mean, obviously, AirVenture has become an event that some people think is maybe the tail that now wags the dog. Do you see any challenges there that in your business background look like something you need to tackle?
Well, there are always challenges there. You know, one of the things that that any organization, whether you're for-profit or not-for-profit, will find itself resource-starved if it tries to do things that it's not capable of doing. So what I like to talk to people in the business world about are your what I call organizational capacity and how well does that organizational capacity balance your financial capacity and how well do those two fundamentals combine to allow you to achieve your ambitions. So organizations that often get themselves in trouble find out that they have been a little bit more aggressive about their ambitions without the balance of organizational capacity and financial capacity to deliver on that. And that's something that at EAA we are working very carefully to manage. We are working very methodically to make sure that we continue to grow and reach and take ourselves to the next level without getting out of balance in those two key important fundamentals, organizational capacity and financial capacity. And with the change of leadership here from Tom to myself, we actually have what's called, what I call, a multiplier effect. Tom is remaining in a very visible, very important role in EAA, not only important today, but critical to the future success of EAA. Tom and I together are a very powerful and complementary set of capabilities. It gives us more capacity to do the things that we want to do and need to do while we operate the organization very effectively and continue to deliver not only on the mission of growing aviation through participation, but delivering on the commitments of value to our membership. So when you talk about AirVenture is the world's largest and most interesting aviation happening. It has a lot of moving pieces and parts to it, just like the EAA has a lot of moving pieces and parts. And it's fair to say, since I've been a member for 21 years, that there are probably more moving pieces and parts to the EAA than most members ever will appreciate, and in some cases probably ever understand. So when you have a new leader who is only the third president in the history of the organization and is also last name not Paul Bresny, that new leader had better bring to the table some very powerful skills running large organizations, making certain that the mission is held true, and making sure that all pieces and parts of the enterprise align with delivering that mission while you maintain clear focus and capability to achieve your ambitions while you balance your organizational and financial capacity.
Since Rod has brought it up, tomorrow in part three, we'll talk about the unique challenges of being the first EAA president not named Poberesny. Rod Hightower is president of the Experimental Aircraft Association. Find out more at EAA.org. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.